ladies and gentlemen. Ever read this book? A lot of people have. And they found it was one of the most vivid, powerful stories they'd ever come across. The book reviewers thought so too. Top-notch ones like Clifton Fadiman, the expert stumper on Information Please, and a noted critic. He sort of summed up the way I feel about this story when he said, "I think it's sort of what you might call a masterpiece." I couldn't put the book down till I'd finished it. And right then I knew more than anything that I wanted to play in a picture made from this story. Well, I was lucky enough to do so. And while it's not ethical for an actor to talk about a picture he's in public that is, I'm going to do it anyway. The Oxbow Incident is the thrilling, dramatic story of the Old West and its fabulous characters as they really were.
Down in Texas, where I come from, we just go out and get a man and string him up.
That's right. I say stretch him. Tain't just a rustler we're after. It's a murderer.
If you got any doubts, Tedley, I say let's call off this party. Take him back to judge like Davies wants.
This is only slightly any of your business, my friend. Remember that?
Hanging's any man's business that's around. That's just a brief idea of what you'll find in the Oxbow Incident. We at the studio think it's one of the most daring and unusual pictures ever made. Jammed with emotional and dramatic impact from the start to the amazing climax. When you see it, we believe you'll agree.
That is what I might do. I could always do it like a whispering ASMR stuff.
And there you go. You're getting a whole new clientele on this podcast.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Awards Don't Matter.
It works better, I think, if the voice doesn't crack under the strain. Oh, God, the pain, the ASMR pain.
Oh, dear. You're not getting any of that this week. No, you're getting a discussion on Oxbow Incident. And while a week has passed in podcast land, only hours have passed in reality, so I still have this voice.
This is why Andrew still sounds like he's in pain. It has only been an hour and a half since our last recording. Yes.
It's okay. Yeah, I'm surviving. So the Oxbow Incident, which is directed by William A. Wellman. We've talked about him before. I'm sure we'll talk about him again in the future. But this is a really masterful film. Dave, as the person with the voice, can you tell us about what this film is about?
Yeah, it is a film that moves very quickly, so it should be very simple to tell us what it's about, right? Because it's only an hour and change. So basically, we're following these two, you know, these cowboys, these ruffians, and they wander into this town. And basically, we find out that a member of this town, a valued member of the community, his cattle has been stolen and he's been killed. So they very quickly are creating a quote-unquote posse, really a lynch mob, to find the people that are responsible for this and judge them and kill them. But essentially, I think a lot of what this movie is about is like the danger of mob mentality. And how hard it is to stand up against that. So that is like the inciting incident. And then the movie just goes. Like, they kind of set up the posse, and then there's a couple beautiful shots of the countryside, and then they catch up with these people right away. And the rest of the movie is essentially this kangaroo court, this sequence where they're trying to figure out, you know, who did what and if they did this thing, and does anyone care if they actually got the right guys? And that is, In a nutshell, that is the Oxbow Incident. So it's a movie that moves very quickly, but I can promise you is absolutely worth your time. Like, this, in terms of like favorite Westerns, this shot up like practically to the top of the list for me. Like, this is
stunning. Your first viewing?
Yeah, I'd never heard, like, okay, that's not true. I was going to say I'd never heard of it. I think listener of the show and friend of ours on Twitter, Zeta Short, had mentioned it like offhandedly, either on a podcast or through our work at In Session Film. And I was like, oh, that's a weird name, and never thought about it again. And then you were like, yeah, we're going to cover this. And it's like, so, you know, it's real short. I watched it on YouTube. it's readily available. I was like, okay. And knowing nothing about it, like, I went into this totally, completely blind and was just knocked for a loop by this movie. I was not expecting. I was like, oh, I like Westerns. It'll be fine. But this is really incredible work. Like, just from, if nothing else, from an efficiency standpoint, like, one of the most incredible movies I've ever seen. Like, it manages in 77 minutes what a lot of films can't manage in 2 hours and change. Like, it just, it is a character piece. It is, it's a good story. It's well filmed. It leaves you with something to think about, and they do it all so quickly. Like, it feels like a movie that would lose its luster, right? Because, like, oh, you move so quickly, you're not really going to get to know these people. But there's, like, there's practically, like, 10 major characters here, and I think you get a grasp of who they all are in that short time. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, there is a really magnificent use of a shorthand here as well, where basically, you know, they touch on who these characters are because of who they are as people. You know, a religious person, you know, a Mexican person. And Henry Fonda's character, who is the main character that we kind of get to know and see this story through. And what I really like about this film is that we get to see how kind Henry Fonda is as a person. And it's masterful casting because it's a lot like James Stewart in a lot of his films, where he's such a kind person. And we see that in his eyes. And then we see that in his performances as well. And, you know, in certain films with Stewart, that kind of kindness is used against the character in a way, like in Vertigo, as we mentioned in the past. But here, for Henry, like, his eyes and his comfort and casualness and just kind of considerate way of looking at the world is very, it's very much part of who Henry Fonda is as a person. And we see that throughout his roles as a character, you know, in cinema history. But here he is the kind person. He is the audience surrogate. And unfortunately, just like the audience, we are unable to stop what happens here. We are sitting here knowing what happens and seeing what happens and knowing that this posse is built together without ever having seen a body, without ever having seen the crime take place, and just on hearsay. And sure enough, there is a moment early on where, you know, they say, because the sheriff is out of town, and they're like, maybe we should wait until the sheriff comes. And they're like, no, we got to get these guys right away. Because if we don't, then they could be gone, and then we'll have lost our chance. And there is the brilliance of this film as well, is it lets you feel, okay, yeah, you're right. If you don't move now, you might lose them. And so at first you're like, okay, yeah, all right, you got to go. And then it unravels so quickly from there. So quickly.
Yeah, so let's talk about Henry Fonda for a minute. This is movie star stuff here.
Oh, yeah.
Like, this is, like, it doesn't matter if, and who hasn't, but it doesn't matter. Even if you've never heard the name Henry Fonda, as soon as he shows up on screen, you know, whatever it is, Henry Fonda's got it. Mm-hmm. Like, you just know right away. Because there is kindness in his character, but it's covered by a little bit of, like, that Western bravado, right? And you can only portray both of those things if you're a movie star, because he does it so efficiently, and there's not a lot of, like, you know, blubbering dialogue about how we got to be good people and blah blah blah. It's just like you see it just behind his eyes, and there's all these, and you see it, because even if he's rough around the edges, he treats everyone like a human being. And that is what separates him from everyone else in this crew, right? Is that he is listening more than he's talking. Everyone else is, like, running off at the mouth constantly. Like, this is what we got to do. I know what's what, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, maybe we should take a second, guys. Like, maybe we should let this breathe a moment, because I don't feel comfortable with this. Something is not right. There's a particular scene where he's, like, sitting there with someone else, and he's just, like, drinking whiskey on horseback. And you can see behind those eyes that he's like, we're headed towards something that isn't right. Like, he knows. And again, he's helpless to stop it. The really interesting thing about this movie is that I think in a lesser movie, this is a mystery.
Mm.
Did they do it? Did they not? I'm not sure. I'm not sure where to go with this. There's no mystery in this movie. You know, I think 2 minutes after they meet this trio, they've got the wrong guys. You know it right away. And yet, they're still, like, and even though you kind of know how this is going to end, there's still suspense and you still care about all these characters. And although Henry Fonda is great, honestly, the standout here for me is Dana Andrews, who plays Donald Martin, who's kind of the leader of the trio who's accused. Mm. I mean, talk about a human performance and a performance devoid of the toxicity of masculinity, especially in Western times. You've got it right here. Like, they make a huge deal about this letter that he writes to his wife. And as I'm watching this, I'm like, there's no way this can live up to what the, and, but it does. Like, yeah, when they finally really read that letter out loud, it is heart-wrenching. It is brutal. And it's like, and of course, at this point, it's a voice from the grave. By the time we hear it, this man is already dead. He's been, let's call it what it is, he's been murdered by a lynch mob for something he did not do.
Just for being. Who will likely get no retribution as well.
Nope.
Like, there will be no fallout from this. These men will continue on living their lives, feeling proud about what they've done.
Right.
Feeling proud about having killed three innocent men, even though they know that the person that apparently was killed is still working around alive. He's perfectly fine.
And that is the gut punch of this movie. Like, the whole movie's full of gut punches, right? It's like, oh, this is horrible. And then to find out at the end, not only did these guys not do it, that there was no crime at all. Like, the man is still alive. He's still walking around. He just got sick and now he's better. Like, I was just like, oh, this is so brutal. And like, they have a little moment of like shame, at least, you know, where that guy basically, where the sheriff basically comes back in and it's like, you know, you have completely screwed this up and you should all be ashamed of yourselves. Like, and they kind of leave with their tails tucked between their legs. Mm-hmm. But like, tomorrow, probably nothing changes. They just go on with their lives and like, yeah, that was messed up. That was a mistake. Anyway. Well,
yeah. See, for me, this film is easy to point to a time where lawlessness reigned. You know, it effectively, men had guns, had horses, and a whole lot of time on their hands. And they were full of whiskey, and they were full of bravado, and they were full of trying to show each other up. And they would go out and find trouble and cause mayhem and cause destruction and end up with people getting killed. And it is pointed that, you know, there is a race aspect to this particular narrative too, because lynching is such a prominent part of American history. But the thing is that I shouldn't be watching this film in 2021 and going, this feels relevant now. Like, I shouldn't feel that. Like, I should be able to go, man, the 1800s were fucked.
Right.
But I'm watching this now and I'm like, the amount of stories that take place about Black Americans getting killed under similar circumstances just because, this person, you know, we heard that something had happened.
Right.
And, you know, this is kind of like a history repeating, basically. Mm-hmm. And that's what I felt so most devastating about this film, is that it doesn't muck around. It, as we're saying, it's 75 minutes long, and it knows that it has a point to get to. And it wants to get there so you can sit there and think about what's just taken place. And then to walk away from this film and go, okay, how can I stop this from happening in my own life? This isn't an outward message film. Like, it doesn't feel like a film that is like, oh, by the way, this. You know, like, we've seen so many different message films, but this feels like a film that is like, American history, not great. Here is why it's not great, and here is how we can improve it. That's my take on it. I just found this a really powerful film, and it's kind of devastating as well that it only got one nomination, like Best Picture. Like, it deserves so much more. I don't know why. You know, I don't know why it only got one nomination, just like Grand Hotel. I got no idea how that only got one nomination.
Yeah, the fact that neither Henry Fonda or Dana Andrews was nominated is criminal. Like, they're both so good. They are perfect performances, both of them. Both very different performances, but they're both phenomenal here. Here's something that makes me sad about this movie. So, you know, you brought up the connection to the experience of Black Americans, right? And I don't think it is a coincidence that they have a Black character go with them, right?
Yeah.
As like, kind of like as this like, oh yeah, see, this makes it okay. He's Black. He's a preacher. It's going to be fine. Here's the thing that makes me sad about that. That actor was uncredited in this movie. Lee Whipper, who played Sparks, who was wonderful, by the way.
Yeah.
In this totally uncredited part. And I was like, God damn it. Like, come on, guys. Like, you know, I understand it was a different time and, you know, all that. But, like, give the man some credit for his work. Because it's not as if it's a walk-on part. He's there.
He's a major role.
Like, 90% of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, I was just like, what are we doing here? Like, I know.
Did you even read your own script?
Right, right. I mean, I know at this time, like, we were literally having Black people be second-class citizens at this time in our country's history. We do it now. We just pretend like we don't. But, like, come on. This guy is, he's in a lot of ways, he's the heart of the movie.
Mm.
He's the one, especially as next to Henry Fonda, like, kind of telling him like it is, you know, like here's what's actually happening here.
Yeah.
And I think if he's not there, if that character's not there, then the character of Gil, Henry Fonda, doesn't take the actions he does. And it's, again, it's such an interesting part for Henry Fonda. And I guess, according to him, it's one of two acting performances of his that he actually liked and was passionate about. It was this and Grapes of Wrath were the two that he really loved. And for good reason here. Not that the other stuff he did wasn't good. He had plenty to be proud of other than this. But
those two
performances are particularly good. It's a strange role for someone like Henry Fonda because he is a movie star. He is a Western movie star, a man of action. And everything that Gil does here is for naught. Like, yeah, he stands up. Yeah, he tries to fight off the posse and let this guy go free. But none of it works.
Mm.
It's useless. Like, we all are against the power of a mob. We can't, no matter what we say, we're not going to stop this from happening. So yeah, he can sleep well at night knowing that he, quote unquote, did the right thing. But what difference did it really make? This man is still dead. This wife still has no husband. This children still have no father. Despite the fact that Henry Fonda looks good in a hat and said the right things, where does that leave us? And that is a strange part for a male movie star to play. Like,
yeah.
It is. Because even, like, he looks at Grapes of Wrath, and Grapes of Wrath, like, is a hero story. This ain't it. This is not a hero story. This is about the idea that, like, it doesn't matter if you stand up and you're heroic. You can't stop it. And it is dour, man. Like, this is, like, you walk away, like... Like, the movie ends, and you're just like, it's weirdly, like, mildly uplifting because you get to hear this letter, but it's also like a, you know, it's a knife right under the ribs.
Yeah.
Like, not only did this awful thing happen, but look at the beautiful soul that you've erased from the world. Like, look at this kind, genuinely kind man.
Who knew what was coming to him. He knew what was coming to him. This is what he wrote.
Yep.
And, yeah, I think... You know, I keep on talking about the era that these films come out and stuff like that, but to think about when this film came out, like right in the midst of World War II, and it's just like, it does feel defeatist in a lot of ways, in a way that kind of feels surprising. You know, surprising from a director like William Wellerman, who I wouldn't have picked having had something that feels so dark. You know, after
dark.
Something like Wings, you know, for example,
right,
which is
right.
Literally the first one that we ever covered, and that is such a optimistic and hopeful film, but there is a bit of darkness there, but the darkness here is just like, there is no message as to how to fight a mob, how to battle evil, how to conquer something that is so defiant in its journey to... you know, conquering others and to, you know, trying to do the right thing. These people think they're doing the right thing. They're, you know, enacting the law and all this kind of stuff. And the question that rings in your mind is kind of like, well, what kind of society exists that allows a group of people to think that going off in the middle of the night to kill a bunch of men for the death of one person, at least, is the right thing to do.
Right.
And there's no answer. There's no answer to that.
It actually, like, you know, I look at the kind of all the movies so far that have been nominated, because I've watched 90% of them at this point. And I'm glad that this was nominated, but I don't understand it. Like, is it worthy of a nomination?
Yeah.
Is it worthy? Absolutely. Yes. But given the Academy and given the time that this was made, to have such a cynical movie be nominated for an award like this is stunning. And it makes me think if that's why it didn't get nominated for other things. Like, because the guy was like, fine, here's your carrot. Here's your Best Picture nomination. No way you're going to win, but here it is. And we're going to walk away from this. Because it is, I don't think there's any arguing that this is a great film. It absolutely is. There's no question. It's beautifully acted. It's beautifully filmed. It's beautifully written. All those things. But like, man, is it depressing. Like, I was just watching this. I actually watched it twice. Like, I watched it, you know, probably 2 weeks ago now. Mm-hmm. And then I, you know, I was sitting around thinking about it and I had to write an article about it. And I was like, I kind of want to watch this again. And of course, it helps that it's, you know, it's 70 minutes, you know, like, okay, yeah, I could just throw this on and I can watch it while I write about it. So I can kind of get the feel of it. But it's shockingly rewatchable for a movie that's so sad and so depressing and so cynical, but the performances are so good. And we haven't mentioned Anthony Quinn, who also gives just, I mean, kind of a tremendous dual performance here, right? Because when he's introduced, he's pretending he doesn't speak English. And he's like, no, I'm a nice person. I'm not da 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 da. And then someone recognizes him and he like tries to run away, gets shot and all that stuff. And then portrays himself.
Yeah.
The real character. And they're so different and both so interesting. It's such an interesting performance, like, because he is the one of the three that you're like, oh yeah, you are suspect.
Yeah, there's like something shady about him. And that's important.
You might have done this, but you did something.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, and it is important. You're right, because that gives these men even more of a reason to do what they wanted to do already. Because, like, make no mistake, this was not about justice. This is about men wanting to kill and finding an excuse to do it.
Yeah.
Like, think about even at the very beginning of the movie when they're rounding up the posse. Look at how excited they all are. This is not like, well, this is rough, but we got to do this because we have to keep the peace. No, it's like, ooh, this is our shot. This is our shot for bloodshed. We can kill someone and no one will say anything to us.
Yeah, they're like hounds out on a fox hunt, you know?
Yes.
They're absolutely. There's no humanity in their eyes, and the performances there are all great because, you know, there is that reality to what they're doing. Obviously this didn't happen. This is a fictional story, but there is a reality to the level of masculinity that's there. And I imagine for the actors as well, having a group of men and just feeding off that energy, that kind of brutish masculinity is, it's intoxicating, you
right.
know, and it's, I personally don't, you know, I struggle with those kinds of groups because of the fact that it is so easy to kind of slip into that. Not me personally, but, you know, I think there's something a little bit terrifying about seeing, you know, groups of men and just like jovial groups of men, because there is something about, there is something like these characters, the look in their eyes of wanting to do something terrible and enjoying it. And that is so familiar for a lot of different reasons.
Right.
You know, we see it like in corporate culture, basically, you know, the boardrooms that are stacked with men. And that's a thing that, again, feels so frightening, is that this narrative is relatable across all situations. It's not just relatable in a cowboy situation. It's relatable in workplaces, in families, in schools.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've seen it as well in Mutiny and the Bounty as well, that kind of thing. And I find that really, really frightening, in a lot of ways because, mm-hmm. you know, obviously all the reasons that we've just said, but I don't know about you, but I find masculinity very frightening because it's confronting. It's terrifying. And, you know, we as men are terrifying. And I say that as a man who has been in rooms with other men and felt threatened. And this film makes me feel that same feeling. And it's uncomfortable, right. and I don't like it. But yeah. I love that the film makes me feel that, though. Yeah.
And it overpowers even the most masculine man of the group.
Yep.
Right?
Exactly.
No one's more masculine than Fonda in this group. Like, you know, the movie starts with him drinking and fighting, like the cowboy stereotype.
What do you have, whiskey?
What do you got?
Whiskey.
You ever see such a guy? All winter I've been thinking, and all he's got's whiskey. That's rotten, ain't it?
Rotten.
Two glasses in a bottle.
So you think, like, oh, he can handle himself. It'll be fine. No, it absolutely won't.
And he's a tall man as well. Like
he's a big dude. He's towers over everybody. Yes, absolutely. And I think that is, you know, of course, purposeful casting, right? Because they want you to have some small moment of hope that, like, he's going to be the hero and he's going to overpower these other nine guys and it's going to be fine. He's going to save the day. And then what happens? He tackles one guy and then he is covered by everyone else. Like, there's nothing you could do. One man against 10, I don't care how big you are, how strong you are. This is not a martial arts movie where, you know, you take on 50 guys and you knock them all out and you never take a shot. No, this is more real. And this is like one against 10, no matter how strong the one is not strong enough.
Yeah.
You cannot stand up against this just on your own. It's rough. And you know, you mentioned kind of the masculinity of the movie, and it's something I find really interesting is the character, I think her name is Rose, the ex-girlfriend of Fonda's character, who just kind of like in the middle of all this just kind of shows up, right? And it's like unannounced, and all of a sudden there's this pretty girl, and it throws everything into upheaval. So what was your, in the midst of all this, like, what was your reaction to the introduction of that character and getting a little bit of backstory about Gil?
It was surprising, and also quite, quite comforting in a way, because you get to see specifically for him, there is a kinder side to him. And we already know that from that, but it's the affirmation of that, the affirmation that, you know, in a time where, you know, this town has no women in it at all. Like, right. It is a town of men. And
well, there's one woman in the posse, right?
Yeah.
There's this one. But she is very masculine in presentation.
Yes, this is true. Yeah. And so when his girlfriend, his ex-girlfriend comes up, there is this feeling of, well, she felt comfortable to be around him. Out of all the cowboys and all the men, and, you know, she felt comfortable enough to be around him. And that's what I felt about that. It strengthened him as a character. I didn't really feel that she was too memorable, though, in the whole scheme of things, which is a bit, it's sad, but also in the same hand, this isn't a story about how men react against women or how women react against men. It's an aspect that kind of lifts that all up, but it's not the main thread of the film. How about you?
Yeah, it's weird to say, but like in a 75-minute movie, I was still like, do we really need this?
Yeah.
Like this movie could be 72 minutes. We don't really need this. Like, I think she's an interesting character. I think it could have actually been expanded more. But like, just as it is, I was kind of like, okay, like, you're right. It does give us yet another example of Gil being a kind man. But I think we get that from how he treats the one black character. We get it from how he's willing to listen to the men who are accused of this crime. Like, we get that pretty clearly. And it's like, it felt like, it's a Western. We got to have a pretty girl. Like, this is what we got to do. So it did feel like kind of paint by numbers stuff. Mm. It's really the only part of the movie that I'm like, it's not a thing where I'm like, oh, this is so awful. But it is a moment where I'm like, this is a weird choice. Feels like there's something on the cutting room floor about this. And I think it also provides a chance for us to see Fonda as cool, right? Yeah. Like, in comparison to this new guy who's kind of a fop and just kind of like, oh, he's a fancy boy. Like, and again, we see Gil like not rise to the bait of like knocking this guy out or making a mockery of him. He just like lets him say his piece, and then he kind of goes off and drinks his whiskey and is by himself. So it creates yet another way for us to like Gil a little bit more, which serves to be all the more impressive because really there's not anything in the script that makes him terribly likable. Mm. It's all performance. It's all
exactly.
Fonda.
Yeah.
Like it's, like I said, like the best way I can describe it is like if this movie had never been made, I don't know that you can make it now. I don't know that we have movie stars like this who could just show up for an hour and just look in the camera and you know that you should be paying attention to them and you know that they're a good guy. Even if they're drinking whiskey and carousing and knocking people out, you still know. Maybe Brad Pitt like is the closest we have to a movie star. But like male movie stars, like who is there? Who's left?
And even then, like nowadays,
Hugh Jackman maybe could play this kind of role, but I don't know if he's rough enough to play that role. I don't know.
Which is an amusing thing. Like people say that about Hugh Jackman all the time, and yet he's an actor who has continually played rough roles. And that's the thing, is that the modern actors nowadays,
too pretty.
They're too pretty, but they also enjoy playing a darker side every so often. You know, Brad Pitt in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Logan and stuff like that for Hugh Jackman. And I just, you know, I was thinking maybe Ryan Gosling, but even then he's like, eh.
Yeah,
I don't
know. But
there's nobody of the same ilk.
He's played darkness and stuff like Drive, I guess, but that is such a stylistic movie that I love Gosling in it, but that is a director's movie, man. That is controlled by the camera, whereas this is much more controlled by the actors. And I just don't know that we have, like, Hugh Jackman. Yeah, I mean, he's played dark roles, I guess, if you're talking about stuff like Wolverine, I guess that's kind of dark, but like it's a comic book and it's like you have a built-in audience for it and people who know it and all that good stuff.
Don't forget his role in Prisoners as well. Like he did some
dark
stuff in there. Yeah.
Okay, that's a good point. I forgot about that one, but that, yeah, maybe. But some of it, like, and this is not to say Fonda is not a good-looking man. He's a stunningly good-looking man. But there's a difference between being ruggedly handsome and being pretty. Hugh Jackman and Ryan Gosling are pretty boys, right? They can play a little bit of darkness, but Fonda looks like, I mean, not to be this guy, but he looks like a man. Like, he looks like a man who has been through some stuff, and he's seen the world, and he's been, like, okay, maybe someone like Daniel Craig could play this kind of role.
Yeah.
He's got that, especially in the first James Bond movie. But it's rare that you see an action hero who looks like he has been punched in the nose a couple times. Maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, Liam Neeson could play a role like this. But neither of those guys are true, honest-to-God movie stars that, like, oh, he's in it, I'm going to go see it. Fonda was. He was one of those guys that would carry a movie no matter what. But, yeah, it's a special performance.
It's
that
really
I don't
impressive.
Know could be recreated.
Yeah. I'd probably say, throwing one more hat in the ring, Garrett Dillahunt, I think, would probably do a very good job of this. But
Who? Nobody knows. I mean, I know who that is. But nobody knows who that is.
But he's not a movie star. But he would be able to do something like this. But
I got it. Timothy Oliphant could play this role.
Yeah.
He could absolutely play this role.
Yeah.
And not just because he was good in Deadwood in a Western stereotype, but like he's got that hero thing and that bit of darkness. So, okay. Maybe Kurt Russell in the day.
Yeah.
He wears a hat well. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. I'm glad we've recast. We should remake this. The Oxbow said we can make it 55 minutes long. We can take out all the women because who needs women in movies? Just get rid of them.
Who's directing it? Sean Levy? We'll get Sean Levy to do it. Yeah.
Me. I'm directing it. This is my movie. You're producing. I'm directing. I'm going to call Timothy Oliphant. We're going to make this happen.
Fantastic. I like it. Yeah. What are you going to call it now? What's the new name for it?
Oh, no new name. We're gonna call it the same thing. We want the comparisons because this is going to be a 5-star Oscar winning
movie. Your film is as dead in the water as it was in 1943, Dave.
Are you telling me Film Twitter is not going to come out and support this?
Unfortunately, not. No, I'm sorry to say. And Film Twitter isn't even out supporting Oxbow Incident already. You know they should be championing this film. Like,
They absolutely should be. Yes, it shouldn't be leaving the Criterion Channel, but it is. That makes me sad.
Yeah, I keep on looking as we go through these older films. You know, I'm like, why isn't Ninotchka more talked about? Why isn't the Oxbow incident more talked about?
Like, yeah, this is up there with, I mean, this is up there with Ninotchka in terms of, like, movies that I had never heard of, yeah, never seen before going through these nominees. And I'm so, like, yeah, there's a lot of, let's be real, there's not a lot of shit, but a lot of, like, middling movies that I've watched because of this. Things I'm like, eh, I'll never think about that again. But I think it's worth it when you come upon something like this that you've, like, never really heard of. Like, what was the other one? What was the Betty Davis The Little Foxes, like that, Ninotchka, so this, like, yeah, phenomenal movies that I never, honestly, I can say this, probably never would have watched because no one talks about them.
Okay, right? But the question is, like, obviously, alongside all of the nominees and stuff, and we talk about this all the time, of course, but, like, some of the films that you've watched that you say are terrible, can you look at them and see that they would have been good then?
Some of them, and some of them, I'm honestly just very confused. Like, I'm like, really? Why? I don't, this?
Because I know a lot of the films are nominated because of politics or because of who's who in the studios and stuff like that.
Well, I've watched, like, 25 war movies, yeah, like, in starting this podcast, yeah. But I have been told, I have been informed by friends of mine that apparently I need to spend more time on lesbian Twitter, because they talk about Ninotchka all the time, oh, okay, which makes a lot of sense. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I need to branch out a little bit.
I don't know how you're going to get an in there, Dave, but, you know.
I don't know. I gotta find someone to vouch for me.
Yeah.
So I can get in with this cool crew of queer women. That's what I'm about. So yeah, but there's, you know, I would say in terms of the movies that I feel like are middling, I would say about 70% of them, I'm like, okay, I get it. It's not for me, and this doesn't work now, but in 1936 or 1941 or 42 or whatever, yeah, I get it. But then there's like a handful where I'm like, oh, this was never good.
Yeah.
This is never good. Like, we just, you know, other movies that got nominated, like, especially this year's nominees in particular, there's like four or five of those that I was like, I don't know if I want to finish this. And I finish every movie. I don't ever stop. I don't ever walk away because I'm a damaged person. So I'm like, okay, I gotta finish this out. But there was like three movies in this crew where I was like, is it over? And they were, a lot of them this year were long too.
Yeah.
They were like 2.5, 3 hour movies. And like, there is no reason.
Because they sent all their fucking editors off to war, probably.
They did. Yeah. They've all got guns and they all, yeah, got helmets now. Can't. Yeah. Bring the editors back. Everyone else can stay at war, but please, for Dave's sake, bring the editors back.
One of the things I find interesting though is that, you know, the celebration of mediocrity and shit doesn't go away in Oscar history. You know, it continues on.
Oh, it doesn't.
You know, The Blind Side and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close and, yeah, and Green Book as well. Like,
Crash.
Yeah.
You win.
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
But that's why we ask about these things and say, you know, does the Oscars matter? And no, they don't matter. But this film matters a lot. And I think it matters so much because of everything that we've talked about. It is an important film. It's a great film.
Yeah, and it's one of those great films that, unlike, so as a comparison, for one of my other podcasts, Your List, My Command, we just watched Mirror, a Tarkovsky movie, which is, by the way, is incredible, but I can't imagine recommending
another one
that
of those,
movie.
Buddy. Yeah, you just, yeah.
I can't imagine recommending it to anybody. Like, I'm like, I don't even know how to describe this. I don't know how to recommend it to you. I literally cannot think of one person. I'm like, you should watch this movie by Tarkovsky. But this movie, I would want to recommend to everybody.
Mm.
Like, it's easy. It's easy to digest. It's a short movie. It's a good movie. It's got movie star performances. It has a message that's important. Like, and it's just really good. Like, this and Ninotchka are probably the two easiest recommendations of anything that we've watched. Like, Casablanca, which we just talked about. Yes, obviously amazing, fantastic. One of the best movies that we've deserved produced in America. Absolutely. But this, I feel like, because it's so underseen and because it's so, and it's so easy to get through, like, everyone should watch this movie. Because it's a, like, it's set as a Western, but I don't think of it like, oh, it's a Western. It's got all the tropes. It kind of, kind of flies in the face of the tropes of the Western. The, like, you know, the man in the white hat, the one man standing alone, fighting the good fight and winning. It's not that movie. It's fighting the good fight for no purpose. That is a brutal, nihilistic view that you usually don't get in Westerns. I, like, can't believe this movie got made. Like, I'm stunned by it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the kind of film that I think that somebody like David Ayer would look at it and go, yeah, I want to make a version of this. And I'm just saying.
Don't put this in the world. If in 5 years there's an Oxbow Incident Ayer cut, I'm coming to Perth and kicking your ass. Don't you put this in the world.
I'm just
don't
saying,
you do it.
Looking at something like Fury, for example, this is like the lineage.
Which is probably Ayer's best movie.
Yeah, and it's an awful film as well. But it's just like, you know, you can see that he in particular, I don't know why I'm bringing him up, but he is a director who's inspired by this kind of nihilistic narrative. And right. And I think what I'm trying to get at is that the nihilism nowadays in films, you know, touching on these kinds of themes, are usually made by filmmakers who really enjoy wallowing in that darkness.
Right.
Whereas you can
right.
tell There's... that William Wellman here is like, I want to get away from this as far as possible.
Yeah.
I've got to tell the story, but I got to get away from it. This is not a nice place to be.
Yeah. There's a weird joy in the nihilism of people like Zack Snyder and David Ayer. Whereas this, like, you are left with your heart ripped out. This is not like, and isn't that edgy and cool? No, there's none of that. It's just like, wow, life is useless. This is fucked up. Like, that's how the movie ends.
Yeah.
It's like, this man is dead now, and we're just going to wallow in it and read this letter and drink because there's nothing else to do about it. Like, ugh. It's rough, man, but it's so good. I'm so glad I got to watch it. Like, leave it to me to, like, find the most depressing movies and watch them twice. This is the second time I've done this. What's the divorce movie with Ryan Gosling?
Blue Valentine.
Yeah, I watched that. I watched it for the first time for a podcast, and immediately the next day watched it again because I apparently just wanted to be really, really sad.
I think I was on that podcast with you.
Yeah, you were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And look at us, two divorced men now. Fantastic.
Yep. I'm happy. It's okay. It's fine. Everything is good, man. Yeah, but it's like, I think I watched this twice, not because I wanted to feel that way again, but because I'm just so in awe of this movie.
Yeah.
Like, the things that it manages to accomplish in such a short time are just like, I can't believe it. Like, every time, like, because when I think back about this movie, it feels like it gets started quickly, but it never feels rushed.
Mm.
And a movie like this should feel rushed. If it's that short and it covers that much, it should feel like we're, like, pushing and pushing and pushing. And it never feels like that. And, like, I mean, I just mentioned it could be 5-10 minutes shorter and still get across all of this. Like, it's incredible. So good.
But these kinds of short films like this, well, it's not a short film, but it's, you know, shorter films like this just highlight the importance of the economy of writing, the economy of editing, and the economy of performances as well. Before I ask the last question.
Are you listening, Marvel? Not everything has to be 3 hours long, jackass.
Just get in
and get out.
Watched this on the day where I watched Army of the Dead, and that thing's fucking 2 hours and 40 minutes long. And it's like, why? Why?
That is my question to you, Andrew. Why? Did you have to review it for your site? Is that why?
No,
or did you do this
just like,
for fun?
I did it for fun. Yeah.
Oh, God. So much worse.
The question which I want to ask before the main question is, because this is such a leaden film, is there a film that you would pair this with that you would recommend people seek out to go alongside it that might be a good kind of softer pairing?
Hmm.
Would you even do that? Or would you force people to sit with it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I keep thinking, the movie I keep thinking of, and probably because it's a Western and it flies in the face of Western ideals, is a relatively recent Western with Michael Fassbender, Slow West. Because it has if you look at the end of that movie, it's got kind of a similar, like, fuck me ending. And, you know, And it really, you really have to sit with it and you really have to deal with what you've seen. And I think obviously it's not as good as this, but I think it would make for quite an interesting double feature. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what I'd pair it with. But if I had the option, I would just want people just to watch this. Like, yeah. Just spend your hour and sit with this, because there's a lot to chew on.
Yeah.
And you know, you could also pair it with all kinds of movies about mob mentality. You could pair it with I'm blanking on the name now. It's a very famous book about the boys who end up with this like mob mentality and kind of end up attacking each other. Lord of the Flies. You could easily pair it with that for sure. Or you could read The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, which became, I think, a Twilight Zone episode at 1.2, which is all about, like, actually the monsters are within us. And when we all gather together, there's a quote about, I can't remember where it's from now, but there's a quote about, you know, a person versus people. It's the idea that, like, you know, a person is smart. People are dumb, scared animals.
Yeah.
And that is what we have here, is when we all get wrapped up in our own nonsense that we end up doing terrible things. So it's like, it's important to have independence. It's important to stand on your own, because if there were more in this party, if there were more people like Gil, something would have changed.
Yeah.
But there was only like two or three people, because there were others who said, no, we shouldn't do this, but no one else who stood up and said no and put their body on the line. Everyone else just stood back except for Gil. That's why Gil is the kind one. That's why Gil is the one who you walk away feeling like this is the only honorable person, and you feel broken and sad because he is, as the movie wraps up.
Yeah. Yeah. The film I would probably recommend people watch alongside this is Destry Rides Again with James Stewart. And
I've been meaning
Dietrich.
To watch that. I haven't seen that one, but it's supposed to be great. Yeah.
It's a very anti-gun violence.
You just like Jimmy Stewart. You just like Jimmy Stewart.
That's, I love Jimmy Stewart. Yeah, I do. I do. But there is a kindness, as I was saying before, there's a kindness to Jimmy Stewart. There's a kindness to Henry Fonda, and both of these films kind of skew that kindness in a really interesting manner. And they both talk about major issues in American history. And, you know, I keep on...
Gun control isn't an issue, is it?
Not at all. You got no problems with guns in America at all.
No, perfectly fine. We got them everywhere.
Yeah.
No problems at all.
Yep.
Ooh, not great.
Yeah.
All right, I'll have to check that one out.
Yeah. That'd be a good pairing.
Did it get nominated for an Oscar? I only watch movies that are nominated for Oscars. You know this. I don't have time for anything else.
It is on the Criterion collection, though, so, you know.
Oh, you know my weaknesses, sir. Okay, fine. I'll watch it.
Yeah. And it has a really, like, an all-timer brawling sequence with Marlene Dietrich against another woman in a bar, and it is...
Okay, I'm sold. I'm sold.
It's a stunner.
Why did you lead with that? Talk about burying the lead.
Yeah, sorry. I'm not very good at selling films, you know.
Right. I care about guns and Jimmy Stewart? No, Marlene Dietrich fighting. That's all I need. Yep. Good to go.
And she sings, too. Yeah, it's good. So does the Oxbow incident matter, Dave?
To me, yes. Clearly it hasn't, because no one has ever heard of it. But it should matter, right? The message matters. The movie itself matters. The way the film is made matters. Yes, it matters 100%. Yes.
Yeah, I agree. And it's this kind of film that makes a statement for why message films need to exist and why they're important in a lot of ways, because this doesn't, even though the narrative is the message, it doesn't actively beat you over the head with it. It just leaves it on the table and presents it to you. Whereas a lot of other message films are like, did you get it? Did you get it? Did you get it? And
like Mrs. Miniver.
Yeah.
Fuck that. I actually, the further I get from that movie, the less I like it. I like it less. I watched that movie. And I was like, it was fine. And now I'm like, man, I don't like that movie at all. Like, I just gets on my nerves. I'm still thinking about that priest at the end of Mrs. Miniver, just ruining everything. The worst.
So talking about priests, what's our next film going to be?
It's Double Indemnity, right? It's Gaslight, right? One of those? No?
No.
No, that's something called Going My Way that I've never heard of. Ugh. I'm sure it's terrible. I don't know. It's directed by Leo McCarey, so it can't be that bad.
It's a musical.
I mean, I do
priests.
Like musicals. So, oh, man. I was with you until that last word. Okay.
You Leo told McCary, me to stop bearing the lead. So, you know, I'm putting that in action.
Musical. Okay. Yeah. Oh, boy. Yes. All right. Well, musical about priests. What could possibly go wrong, Andrew? What could possibly go wrong?
Who knows? And we haven't decided on what film we're going to pair it with. But
I've decided what we're going to pair it with.
Okay. What is it? Jesus Christ.
We're gonna do Gaslight because it's supposed to be really great and I've never seen it, so it gives me an excuse.
And it is a literal term. Term in society. So
yeah. So let's do Gaslight. I mean, I'd be fine doing Double Indemnity. It's a great movie, but I've seen that like 5 times. So
I've never seen it at all. So these are new watches for me. All three of them.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well, we'll either do Gaslight or Double Indemnity. How about that? We'll agree to one of those two.
Fantastic. I think we'll do Gaslight and then we'll release an episode of Double Indemnity just so listeners get to feel what Gaslight was about. You know, but I'm just...
We're lying to you. Yeah. Very good. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. I'm here all week. Yeah. So look, where can people follow you on Twitter as well? And
oh
all
God,
kind of stuff.
Why on earth would you want to do that? Yes, I am on Twitter too often, less often now. It's like my time is being filled with something else. Who knew? but you can find me on Twitter at Darn That Dave. You can tell me how wrong I am about Mrs. Miniver and how right I am about the Oxbow incident because I will brook no argument about the Oxbow incident. It is fantastic. One of the best movies we have covered on here. But yeah, you can find me at Darn That Dave. And where can they find you, Andrew? They should talk to you so you're on Twitter more, not talking about nonsense. You can talk about something real like Oscar movies.
Oscar movies, yeah. The Kobe U. Do that. I'm currently talking all about Australian films, which is a surprise. I've never done that before. And, you know...
Those are not Oscar movies, Andrew. Talk about Oscar movies. Talk about movies worth your time, not this Aussie nonsense.
Aussie.
Like
Aussie.
Crocodile D.
Oscar nominated Crocodile Dundee. So The Curb AU.
But if you want to talk to Andrew about Australian movies, you should talk about The Actors, my absolute favorite awards name, because it sounds like actor with an Australian accent. The Actors. It's great.
Yeah, and you do it so well. In fact, you have a perfect Australian inflection there, so it's wonderful.
It's the only word that I have the right inflection in, because it guides me to it. I love it. Yes. Yeah.
Well, as a small suggestion for people, one of the films that, actually two of the films that won Best Picture at the Actor Awards have just got released on Blu-ray with stunning transfers. And one of them is Malcolm, which is a film starring Colin Friels. And it's a really wonderful film. And I highly recommend everybody pick that up. It's a great disc. And it's a lot of fun. Really nice, charming little film. So yeah, The Curb AU is where you can find me on Twitter. And also Us Awards Don't Pod on Twitter as well. And previous episodes at thecurb.com.au. For now, we will see you again on the next episode for now, where we will talk about Going My Way. Joy. Yeah, I'll hopefully have a better voice by then. Yeah, might sing
Yay,
a tune or something.
Priest, yeah, priest singing. It'll be great. Can't wait.
Yep.
You ought to read this letter, too. You know I can't read. Read it to you. My dear wife, Mr. Davies will tell you what's happening here tonight. He's a good man and has done everything he can for me. I suppose there's some other good men here too, only they don't seem to realize what they're doing. They're the ones I feel sorry for, because it'll be over for me in a little while, but they'll have to go on remembering for the rest of their lives. Man just naturally can't take the law into his own hands and hang people without hurting everybody in the world. Because then he's just not breaking one law, but all laws. Law's a lot more than words you put in a book, or judges or lawyers or sheriffs you hire to carry it out. It's everything people ever have found out about justice and what's right and wrong. It's the very conscience of humanity. There can't be any such thing as civilization unless people have a conscience. Because if people touch God anywhere, where is it except through their conscience? And what is anybody's conscience except a little piece of the conscience of all men that ever lived? I guess that's all I got to say, except kiss the babies for me and God bless you. Your husband, Donald.
Where are we going?
He said he wanted his wife to get this letter, didn't he? Said there was nobody to look after the kids, didn't he?